Welcome to History Here and Now. I'm Thomas Richardson, the voice inside your podcast machine, and today is a great day to learn about history. Now, the HHN podcast is dedicated to bringing you great stories from the past, and here we talk about people, places, events, culture, and practically every other facet involved with history. Does it sound complicated? Well, history is just that, complicated, but it doesn't have to be. I'm here to help break things down and make history more fun and relatable, so let's get started. So today I want to talk about a personal passion of mine, and that involves studying the Vietnam War. And I know that the Vietnam War experience is something that has divided Americans, not only about the military, but about how they understand their government, but it also divides them on a personal level. You know, they've had family members who were impacted by the war, whether they served overseas or they knew someone who served overseas. And in many ways, it's as divisive a topic as the Civil War. You know, were there good reasons for us being over there? You know, did we gain anything as a nation from it? Did we learn anything from it as a nation? Was more decades have gone by, as the decades continue to go by, those will still be questions that we're asking ourselves. On March 29th, 1973, the last combat troops left South Vietnam as part of the Paris Peace Accord Agreement. In exchange for all active duty personnel leaving, all American POWs also left as well. And by that point, only security guards and security details left at specific installations like U.S. government buildings, embassies. They were the only military personnel left in the country. And today's subject sort of comes from a book that I had read recently by a former CIA officer who had served in South Vietnam by the name of Frank Snepp. Now, if that name sounds familiar, that's because he was interviewed as part of the Ken Burns Vietnam War documentary, and he's been featured in other documentaries as well concerning Vietnam. Mr. Snepp has been a correspondent for various news organizations, and he's written a book about his experiences in the final days and the fall of Saigon. His book, Decent Interval, was actually part of a Supreme Court case whereby information that came from a CIA officer who had signed a non-disclosure agreement had wondered whether he had actually violated his contract in talking about the events that happened within the CIA at that time. And Mr. Snepp eventually lost that case, but he had sparked a landmark event in when it comes to whistleblowers and how government employees or government agents can still hold government agencies accountable for their actions. And it really is a fascinating and a really dense book at that much. And today I sort of want to go over what I had learned about it and how this book can actually teach you a great deal about our final experiences in Vietnam. So to sort of set the stage, in April of 1975, you really have to understand that there is nothing but chaos. People are left behind. There is sheer destruction. The country has been ravaged by 30 years of war. There are thousands of South Vietnamese civilians and soldiers who are living in perpetual agony, whether or not Americans would help rescue them from the approaching North Vietnamese Army, or NVA as we'll call them. Meanwhile, the South Vietnamese Army, the Republic of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, which we'll call the ARVN from now on, there were still fragile agreements, empty promises, diplomatic false flags, everyone trying to negotiate a compromise for what was left of South Vietnam. Now, to say there are miscommunications and misunderstandings between parties is a definitively gross understatement. So between October 1972 and April 1975, Frank Snepp worked furiously on deciphering North Vietnamese plans while trying to navigate a labyrinth of bureaucratic stonewalling and intelligence mismanagement. There were desperate signals of non-negotiable settlements with an almost willful denial of reality by senior leaders. Now, It's important to know that this case is that when the United States have left by this point, they now want nothing left to do with Vietnam. In between 73 and 75, the American public is pretty much tired of whatever is now going on in Southeast Asia. They've been enduring it for almost 10 years, and by this point, them and Congress have wanted to have no other association and are not willing to give South Vietnam any more help. Now, the title phrase, decent interval, is interesting as well. It references a theory that the Nixon administration had orchestrated plans to allow for a peaceful withdrawal from South Vietnam to avoid a military defeat. The Republic of Vietnam could not survive, according to sources, including people like National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, who was quoted as saying, our terms would eventually destroy him, but him referring to the president of South Vietnam, Nguyen Van Thieu. There are presidential, political, and military and Vietnamese scholars have sort of debated this practice, and while Kissinger denies the decent interval concept, the fact remains that while the United States remained committed to South Vietnam in public, a mirage of hope prevailed privately that many Vietnamese clung to, but it still never came to fruition. Now, President Nixon had privately pledged to Thieu that if his country was ever threatened again by the NVA, U.S. air power would retaliate with full force. Rather than committing ground troops, the United States Air Force would be the shield against communism. But now, Nixon's resignation came as the watershed moment of Watergate, pun intended, but it was finally an opening to the communists. They had been so frightened of what Nixon would do, given his implacable anti-communist stance, that they were afraid that he would actually re-intervene with air power. But now with Nixon no longer in the picture and Ford assuming the presidency, the NVA could finally launch a final assault on the South and finally reunify the country. By the time Nixon resigned, the South's fate was essentially sealed. And it's during this time that Snap's account and chronicles the events and the people that took part in it. Now, a principal actor who exerted enormous, disastrous influence was U.S. Ambassador Graham Martin. Now, Martin had entered South Vietnam in June 73 with the goal of retaining South Vietnam independence by any means necessary. Now, a lot of people have described him as this resolute old guard cold warrior. He was determined to keep U.S. aid flowing into the country. And Snep definitely does not kid gloves when it comes to his criticisms of Martin. You know, as Snep repeats throughout the book, Martin was more concerned with conforming information and his news to his worldview rather than taking facts to heart from trusted sources. Of course, this made his relationship with the media not stellar either. But now Martin even refused at one point to even cut down a tamarind tree in the embassy courtyard to allow for helicopter liftoff, saying that it would hurt morale and incite panic. Well, by that point, the frenzied crowds of frightened Vietnamese should have signaled the oncoming doom, and saving the tamarind tree was akin to throwing furniture off the sinking Titanic. No matter what you were going to do, the handwriting was on the wall. There was nothing you could do to stop the inevitable. Now, Snep also does not just focus on the United States actions as well. He also focuses on the South Vietnamese. There are many critiques about President Thieu's regime and the South Vietnamese army who are still struggling to hold on to key points in the country. You know, Thieu had taken up command of the army himself, and in many cases, his woeful ineptness when it came to military affairs had disastrous results on the remnants of the Arvin. The unceremonious departure of President Thieu and potential smuggling of valuables in his luggage, because they could hear the clinking clanking of, you know, silverware, other valuables, maybe some gold bullion and bars, but, you know, we'll never know. It illustrates how reading the writing on the wall came too late. Leaders tried desperately to mount defenses on their own, but their over-reliance on the United States became their Achilles heel. They had built an army in the image of the United States when Vietnam was not the United States. They built an army that their economy could not support. And in fact, they had a false economy for many years. You know, they had depended on U.S. aid, you know, to keep their prices stable. They depended on soldiers continually remaining in country and buying Vietnamese goods. But as soon as all of that departed the country, the South Vietnamese economy just imploded. The RVN was plagued with corruption, low morale, and with the evaporation of U.S. financial and military aid, they also ran out of money and bullets. And that same corruption extended to the government, where competing factions constantly jockeyed for power. And there were disagreements every day. And now, with only communists days away from unifying the country, they assumed larger importance with political settlements. And during all this time, Snap is working as an intelligence officer specializing in communist infiltration, and he's getting reports after reports of just the worst things you can imagine, the worsening situation. Now, disheartening that they were about the collapse of armed divisions, there were hit-and-run tactics by the Viet Cong, they're flooding into Saigon, and they're forcing more and more people at the U.S. Embassy to prepare for the worst. Now, the embassies and other U.S. installations have evacuation plans on hand, but there was disagreements over how many of the personnel they could get out, at what time, who was considered essential and non-essential, and on top of this, the embassies were employing thousands of Vietnamese locals that may or may not have been, you know, considered essential or not. Should they have been left behind? Should they have been all whisked away as fast as possible? Well, those were points that they had been disagreeing about in the weeks and months leading up to the collapse of Saigon. So, now Frank Snap cites the defense attaché's office, which was the go-between of the United States armed wing at the time after the main combat forces had left. The colonel, Bill Legro, was cited as a principal architect for the Saigon evacuation. They'd come up with prearranged rendezvous points around the city to pick up Americans with proper credentials. And now the South Vietnamese, who through a mashup of bribery and American largesse, they thrust themselves into the evacuation even if official policy did not include them. You know, many people actually spent their life savings, according to Snap, just to be able to get a stamp from a consular office giving them a pass out of the country. They would do anything to leave because they knew as soon as the communists invaded, they would have been targeted, they would have been arrested, and in many cases, just right out executed. Now, the CIA station chief, Thomas Polgar, had still held out hope for a negotiated settlement arbitrated between the Soviet Union and China. But as Snap described it, the CIA and the U.S. Embassy botched a great deal of the evacuation prep work because of these misconceptions on intelligence validity. And Snap also spends this time evaluating the actions of many people in the last days of South Vietnam. He criticizes Polgar increasingly over his handling interpretations of intelligence sources. And even for a brief time, Polgar shared similar reviews as Ambassador Martin concerning negotiated settlement with the communists. And this came as a tip from Hungarian associates and the International Commission of Control and Supervision. And as time progressed, NVA forces captured surrounding towns like Xuân Lộc, and they were cutting communications and highways out of Saigon. More and more hopes of negotiation just evaporated. There was nothing that they could grasp onto. Nothing concrete was going to come of any negotiated settlement. Hovering over the embassy was a political front centered on the U.S. Congress, who did finally have the final say on authorizing military and aid funds to South Vietnam. Ambassador Martin, National Security Advisor Kissinger, and others desperately needed Congress to act. If South Vietnam were to fail, Congress, and not the White House, the State Department, or the CIA should take the blame. Snap interprets congressional machinations and their impacts in the broader context. of how the U.S. handled foreign relations with South Vietnam. If the U.S. government was unwilling to move proactively in warding off disaster, people on the ground were the ones who had to act swiftly. And now we come to the pivotal month and year, April 1975, the year where all hell had broken loose in Saigon. Now, the book Decent Interval is only half of the book's title, but the latter aptly describes the landscape, an insider's account of Saigon's indecent end told by the CIA's chief strategy analyst in Vietnam. Now, no one who wasn't there couldn't have described it as vividly as Snip did. Between April 6 and April 29, the NVA hit major points around Saigon, including the famous Tan Son Nhut Air Base and the port of Vung Tau. Evacuation plans were still in disarray as senior leaders argued over how many personnel should be lifted out and when. Americans had to be rescued, but determining at-risk Vietnamese was problematic and time-consuming. Peace was a far-flung hope, but by that point, they couldn't rely on supposed peace process. They had to save people. They needed to get people out. Now, Snip cites in this principal obstacle in helping to coordinate withdrawal, where he says, and I quote, "My ambrosio with Polgar left me bitter and frightened. For as long as he and Martin refused to accept the inevitability of a communist assault, it seemed likely they would continue to subordinate the evacuation effort to their peace gambit. In my anxiety, I resolved to try to signal to Washington once again, as I earlier through Moose and Messinger, how far off touch I thought they were." Now, the President Ford discussed the worsening situation in South Vietnam and by this point, he was really holding out hope that emergency aid would block off any potential collapse. And while that all occurs, Snap intimately recalls how he and his colleagues worked outside the system and broke every convention to get people out of there, some whom they knew personally. Now these latter chapters and sections make Decent Interval a heart-wrenching read. One is immediately placed in the hot, humid, and bullet-ridden Saigon city blocks. He intricately weaves descriptions of civilians facing harsh decisions and finding creative ways to escape the country. Americans with proper credentials were collected, but many Vietnamese were still left behind upon realizing they could not make it. Now, on April 29th, 1975, the NVA initiated what they knew was the final assault on Saigon. They attacked from five sides in the city, as one commander described it, like a hurricane. Intelligence reports drafted by Snap revealed how the communists were determined to drive into the city and claim it by Ho Chi Minh's birthday, May 19th. Cargo ships, commercial airplanes, and military airlifts were swamped with frightened civilians carrying their life possessions. And by this point, there were prearranged evacuation plans. They had planned for a military airlift, a commercial airlift, putting people on steamers and putting them out to the ocean. And then as a final desperate act and very last option, a helicopter airlift where they would still be able to save Americans, but they would leave a significant number of Vietnamese civilians behind. The Ford administration emphasized evacuating all Americans and their Vietnamese dependents, which of course resulted in explosions of Americans claiming quote-unquote dependence. The best way to describe the scenario was, well, haphazard. The worst description, you could call it a shit show. Operation Frequent Wind, the official military-directed evacuation, was initiated the day before, but without guidance from Ambassador Martin or the DAO. The military airlift had to be improvised, flying in helicopters and ferrying them out to Task Force 76, the U.S. Naval Fleet in the South China Sea. CIA pilots and civilian contractors were flying their own helicopters trying to rescue Americans. And I know all of us have seen sort of that famous image of a CIA officer helping civilians up a narrow ladder. It's actually part of a helicopter's on the top of a pad that's off an apartment complex. There is one man leading out, reaching for a civilian, and you just see a throng of people going down this narrow staircase, everyone clamoring up there, trying to get up to the helicopter. Well, it's a famous image on top of 22 Jialong Street. And it was an Air America chopper, which Air America was the airlines used by the CIA. That was a defining moment in the fall of Saigon. Many people mistakenly attribute it to being the U.S. Embassy, but it's not. It's an apartment building. But still, that moment, whenever people think of the fall of Saigon, they instantly will think of that picture. Now, the CIA chief, Thomas Polgar, at this point, had radically changed his view on the military situation. Oh, wait, the enemy's right there? Well, I guess peace isn't going to happen at all. He scrambled to save personal Vietnamese friends, destroying classified information. There were sets of incinerators that were just going around the clock in the building. Up near the helicopter pad, they were just dumping in classified documents, you know, personnel lists of Vietnamese contractors and employees. They were trying to burn all evidence of intelligence and collaboration with the South Vietnamese. Polgar wrote in his final cable to Washington, D.C., a statement that resonated with historic implications, where he says, quote, "It has been a long and hard fight, and we have lost. This experience, unique in the history of the United States, does not signal necessarily the demise of the United States as a world power. The severity and defeat and the circumstances of it, however, would seem to call for reassessment of the policies of half measures which have characterized much of our participation here, despite the commitment of manpower and resources, which were certainly generous. Those who fail to learn from history are forced to repeat it. Let us hope that we will not have another Vietnam experience and that we have learned our lesson." Saigon, signing off. Late into the evening of April 29th, Snap and the last of the CIA personnel made their way to the embassy roof helicopter pad, boarded a CH-47, and flew out to the sea, landing on the USS Denver. Now, below them were throngs of civilians clamoring for salvation. Time and again, they were reassured that helicopters would pick them up. But these were empty promises, as only Americans were now evacuated. Any remaining U.S. military personnel, the guards, they were told to have the Vietnamese to keep them warm, which basically means don't make any signal that all these promises have been for naught. You know, officers like Captain Stuart Harrington, who at the time said that he felt sick to his stomach and even found a way to say, well, I have to go to the bathroom, please excuse me, and use that as his exit out of the building and onto the helicopter. Within 24 hours of landing on the USS Denver, Snap finally heard the news he knew was coming. Saigon capitulated and was renamed Ho Chi Minh City. The Vietnam War was finally over. Now, personally, this massive tome was startling. Snap's inside accounts and direct knowledge of communist operations really made me rethink a few things. First, what I was taught in my U.S. and the Vietnam War class in my undergrad years was severely watered down and glossed over the finer points of Kissinger's double dealing, the sheer stupidity of Graham Martin, and the South Vietnamese government's practically non-existent democratic institution. The enormously perplexing situation inside the U.S. embassy makes no wonder of why evacuation plans were constantly outdated or rendered useless. Now, above all, Snep laments for the thousands of civilians left behind who worked for the United States, and they were the worst victims. They faced prison, re-education camps, and execution by the communists. Later, in testimonies before Congress, Ambassador Martin claimed that the evacuation was still an astounding achievement of American planning and execution. But at that moment, Snep resoundedly disagrees, stating, and I quote, "Some legislators, however, were not so sure. Although none disputed the difficulties the ambassador had faced, there lingered widespread suspicion that he had brought a great many of them on himself. Far from expediting the evacuation during the first weeks of April, he had, it seemed, helped to stall, if off partly by fostering the notion, with Kissinger's help, that one more aid appropriation might avert disaster. Even then, it was less Martin's ingenuity than the imagination and initiative of subordinate staffers that kept the operation rolling. Without General Smith's inspirations, there probably would never been no evacuation at all. The improvisatory and haphazard nature of the evacuation, of course, had its cost." Now, every bit of intelligence pointed to a non-negotiable communist victory. Hanoi would not suffer compromise under any circumstances. So why couldn't Kissinger, Martin, or Polgar understand this notion? Why wait until the last minute to make a crucial decision on saving lives? Well, Snep points to the far-flung hopes for negotiated settlements through Soviet channels and the constant pressure for congressional appropriations to foreign aid. Following Watergate and the passage of the War Powers Act, senators and representatives were still always unwilling to approve any more aid. Reluctance after years of anti-war protests pushed Congress and the White House to focus on domestic issues such as inflation, unemployment, and foreign relations in the Middle East. No one cared for Vietnam any longer. Decent Interval was an exploration of the mine for any concerned person living in Saigon on April 30th, 1975. In later testimony, Snep laments the loss of so many Vietnamese who weren't evacuated. In a way, this book memorializes them. Rescued families were lucky ones and would always remember the time as Black April in their life. Snep's book set a new bar for my own understanding of the Vietnam War. In a great personal sacrifice, Snep brought to light what many Americans tried to forget and still try to today. So much went wrong with the evacuation. Had it not been for a brave, enterprising people, so many more would have lost their lives. A History Here Now is a website dedicated to the research and writing about different historical topics. And so if you like this podcast, hit the like button, share it on social media, recommend it to your friends, family, colleagues, mortal enemies, anyone you can think of who enjoy hearing a history discussion. You can follow HHN on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and check back every week for the next episode. Until then, good luck on this crazy ride called life. We'll be right back.